The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to welcome you to this evening. I guess it's entitled, Make Your Child Shine. And certainly something that we would all love to be able to do. I just want to thank all of the participating shuls and rabbonim, especially Rabbi Baruch Pesach Mendelson and his shul, who actually begun to spearhead this project. I had the honor of spending a Shabbos with them earlier in the year, and we hope that this will be the first of many presentations that hopefully will be to the ultimate benefit of our children and our families. I don't think it's news to anyone today that there are a lot of problems out there. For years, we may have been denying, we may have been ignoring, we may have been fooling ourselves, but today it's quite clear and quite obvious that a significantly large number of yeshiva students, both girls and boys, teenagers and even preteens, are positioned for challenge and maybe trouble and failure at some imminent point in their school career. Much has been talked about, much has been written about this subject. Something has been done about it, but certainly the problem is not going away. It doesn't seem to be going away at any time in the near future. On the other hand, the good news is, and this from my personal perspective in sponsoring a school which deals with some of these types of problems, the kids that have drifted are coming back in very, very significant numbers with great passion and enhanced commitment, and oftentimes, I would say even most often, achieving levels of commitment in Yiddishkeit and growth in learning and in shmiras Torah mitzvahs beyond what many of their friends have achieved and probably beyond anything that they could have achieved had they not gone this circuitous path. However, that doesn't make it any easier to deal with and to tolerate the difficulties that we have. And it doesn't assure us that any individual child or any individual group of children will be able to turn the corner, so to speak, and return. That having been said, it's extremely critical, we believe, and I would say years of experience in dealing with these problems teaches us that the probably most, or by far most effective antidote or resolution to this problem is, I guess it could be called in very rough terminology, training. Training for mechanchim and training for parents. But not training in the basics of teaching and in the basics of parenting, but in the issues of prevention of problems, early detection of problems, and Rachmona Litzlan, crisis intervention. Areas which maybe years ago we didn't have to know or it wasn't as critical to know, and today it's literally a matter of life and death. In a meeting with Rav Eliashiv Shlita about 2 years ago, he told us that in his opinion, this issue of training is a matter of pikuach nefesh, and it's poshut uborur, those were his words, that this has to be done by everyone who deals with our youth today. And it's in this light that we have attempted, and we, Baruch Hashem, have been quite active in presenting programs like this in communities around the country to try to awaken the awareness of the problem and maybe more specifically to give parents and mechanchim, most times in different settings and sessions, the sense of what we can do to avoid and to prevent and to deal with, or better deal with, these challenges that face our children. The topic this evening that Dr. Pelkovitz will speak about is entitled, It's All About Validation. Just a word before I introduce Dr. Pelkovitz. It's told, and I heard it from reliable sources, that before the Alter from Slabodka, who was really the mastermind, the architect of the yeshiva world, certainly the Litvish yeshiva world as we know it today, and Ruba of the Rosh Yeshiva of the previous generation, were his Talmidim both here in Eretz Yisrael and throughout the world. Before he started his yeshiva, he met with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and he asked him, Vi macht man a yeshiva? How do you make a yeshiva? And Rabbi Yisrael, it's told, quoted him one posuk. Lahachyus nefesh folim, ulahachyus lev nitkoim. That the tafkid of the yeshiva is to breathe life, is to uplift downtrodden and broken hearts, broken spirits. I guess, in a sense, to lift them up and to make them feel good about themselves, make them feel proud about themselves. And this, it's known that this was the basis with which he started the Slabodka Yeshiva. And Slabodka Yeshiva virtually forged a revolution in the attitude towards B'nai Torah and the attitudes of B'nai Torah to themselves. And I think that this was extremely far-sighted in terms of the generation that we're in today. For some reason, and it's I'm sure Dr. Pelkovitz has better insights in it than I do, but for some reason, our kids are not feeling so good about themselves. We haven't succeeded, maybe not as parents, maybe not as educators, to uplift them and to give them that sense of greatness, of their potential greatness, of feeling good about themselves. And with that, they stand to be ready, poised to conquer the world. Without it, they stand to be devastated and oftentimes just to give up. So it's with that in mind that it's a great privilege and pleasure to introduce Dr. David Pelkovitz. I can only tell you on a personal note that I don't think. I have never met an individual who has so much to offer, so in demand, and yet so accessible. Accessible to groups like this and accessible to individuals wherever the need may be. His insights, his caring, his sensitivity, his mastery of the full gamut of these problems, and I'm sure so many other problems, have helped, I'm sure, thousands of people throughout his years of working in the field to be able to find the right path, to be able to get the right grasp on the situation, and to turn around the lives of their children. So I think we as a community, and certainly on a personal level, should be very grateful for Dr. Pelkovitz for once again sharing his wisdom, his insight, and his time. And we're very appreciative and honored to introduce Dr. David Pelkovitz.
Okay. A lot more men than usual. How did the women get you to come out tonight? It's very unusual. So, yasher koach for bringing them out. Let me get a sense of how many of you have mainly adolescents at home? Okay. How many of you have mainly pre-adolescents, future adolescents, God willing, at home? Okay. None of the men raised their hand, which has me a little worried. Okay. I want to thank Rashaya Cohn for the wonderful work he's done in reaching out to the kids who need us most, the kids who somehow elude the bumper sticker of our society and are out floating around desperately in need of us holding their hands. And nobody does it better than Rabbi Cohn and all the wonderful programs he set up here in Eretz Yisrael. He's made an enormous difference. I can tell you some great stories, but I won't embarrass him now. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to make a couple of core points, but I was also asked to have a question and answer period where you could tell me about your neighbor's kids' problems. Okay, so we'll get going here. First of all, Let me start by, it's interesting. I didn't come up with the title, but it's a nice title. It's all about validation. And that's an interesting title, because what it's talking about, which is very fitting for this week's parsha, for Vayechi, is that the key to parenting, in part, is figuring out a way to pay attention to the unique needs of our children, okay? And that's a very hard thing to do. We all know what it's like to have little kids at home all complaining it's not fair, and it's almost like a unique issue that I see more in from families than in general population, that, you know, you'll have a family of 5, 6 kids, and they all have the same bedtime, because the younger kids will complain that, hey, it's not fair, I should go to sleep before my older brother or my older sister. And the reality is, as you know, that the way to parent kids, which is the theme of this week's Parsha, is according to their own unique needs. So there's the beautiful pasuk in this week's Parsha of Ish Asher Kfi Berchaso Berachosam, that every one of the children of Yaakov got a unique bracha. And Rav Yerucham Levavitz says beautifully on that pasuk, he says, if you try to bench your kids and you bench them in a way that your wishes and dreams for them are based on your own fantasies or based on what your dream is. So if your bumper sticker is Lakewood or Die or Chesed or Else or whatever it is that you care the most about, and you give a bracha to your child who has an attention deficit and probably is not destined to be in Lakewood in any other way than to probably donate a wing one day, because those are the kids who may become incredibly successful financially and become incredible Bali Tzaka one day, but they don't necessarily have the zitzflesh to be able to sit down and to learn or to even have necessarily the basic unique set of strengths that it takes to make it as a full-time learner. The problem is, Rabbi Yerucham says with his brilliant psychological insight, that when you bench a kid and you give a bracha to a kid that they should grow up to be that way, and that's not their temperament, he says it's like pouring water on a field that has no seeds in it. It's literally a bracha levatala. He says a bracha only takes hold when it's designed to match the uniqueness of each individual child. And that's the key. That's the key of parenting. That's what tonight's theme is about, is how do you find that spark of uniqueness, and how do you expand your bumper sticker to take in the basic strength that it takes to have them find their way based on their own unique set of needs. Shasha Rafal Hirsch says something fascinating on the brachas in this week's parsha. She says, if you look at them, they're actually not brachas. They're descriptions. They're descriptions. You know, go. Get Vayechi, open it up, and you'll see description of son after son after son. Obvious question is, so how's that a bracha? How's it a blessing to describe a person? And the answer is, that's the ultimate validation. When you feel that your father gets you, when you feel that your mother gets you, that's the ultimate bracha. And that's when you reach your potential, and that's when the dreams that we have for our children come true. Let me tell a story tied to a priority one Shabbaton, and then I'll move on. And hopefully I'm going to try to make this tachlis-oriented also, though the questions will probably bring that stuff out as well. Here's the story. There's a priority one Shabbaton that I was privileged to be at a few years back. And one of the things that becomes very clear at this Shabbaton, which is designed to serve and sensitize Rabbanim and Mechanchim and families about what leads to at-risk kids, is that very often it is the kid who somehow eludes our protective shield. So Rabbi Cohn brilliantly has a program where he'll have, let's say, 7, 8 people on a dais who had been members of the Frum community and now have left. Some have come back, but most of them had left. And there's a simple question posed to them. What was it that led to your leaving our beautiful way of life? And it's very interesting because the answers are all different. There's different pathways that lead to it, but the answers are all the same. What the answers are all about is somehow it's a child who, for a variety of reasons, doesn't quite fit, grows up feeling like they really don't fit. So you may have a child who grows up in a family that tremendously values secular learning. And this kid just doesn't have those kind of abstract thinking skills. And then there'll be another child who had early chorea problems that weren't diagnosed. And because of that, gradually feels like he's pulling away little by little by little. And then another child who, chas v'shalom, might have a history of undisclosed abuse. And that makes them feel marginalized. And as a result, they sort of turn off on in terms of their emunah. And they pull back little by little by little. And what they all have in common is they find solace by hanging out with equally marginalized peers. So there was a speaker Friday night at this Shabbaton. And the speaker was Rabbi Brafman, the principal of Yeshiva Far Rockaway. And he said he noticed Friday night at the meal how is when parents, when fathers were benching their children, he noticed something I had never noticed before. He noticed something unbelievable. And once I paid attention to it, I now see it every Friday night. Okay, and this will lead to my first recommendation. He noticed that as children were being given the bracha on Friday night by those there who had that minhag, each child related to his or her father in a unique kind of way. So one child related in one way, another child related in another way, and he saw that it captured somehow the uniqueness of that child. And his basic recommendation to us was, go home from now on Friday nights, when you bench your child, try to capture the uniqueness of your relationship by the way they relate to you and bottle that during the week. Because that's the flame that you want to fan. That's what you really, it's the spark you want to ignite. And I had never noticed this before. I'm supposed to be a psychologist. I never noticed it. And the next Friday night, as I'm benching my kids, I see this whole interesting kind of subtlety in the way I bench each of my kids. So my oldest son is this big macho guy, and I have to reach up to him. We have this macho thing going. Then my next daughter, has a tremendous amount of chen as an objective father. So it's the chen thing that gets captured as I bench her. And the next daughter is really funny, okay? So we have this funny thing going. And then the next daughter is cuddly, et cetera, et cetera. And I started to realize this is a really powerful thing. It's a really powerful thing captured in Vayechi, captured in the Rav Yeruchim on Ish Asher Kavi Berchasa Berachosam. And in a way, it's a metaphor for the way we raise our children. And a lot of it has to do with the expectations we have of them. We need to have goals and expectations for our children. There's a beautiful pasuk that says, "Be'en chazon yifara'am." Without vision, without goals, we sort of drift away. Beautiful pasuk. We need vision for our children. We need expectations for our children. But they have to fit. So here's the story. Story is, I said over this vignette about what I learned from Rabbi Brafman that night at a Priority One Shabbaton. And I said it over to a group of mental health people on a Sunday morning program. And a psychologist comes over to me and he tells me about a session he had earlier that morning. And it goes like this. He said he was working with a kid who was beginning to become rebellious. Wasn't quite there yet. And the kid told him the following story that had happened the evening before. He said he was hanging out with some friends, and they were like minor troublemakers. They weren't into the major leagues or anything. Some kids, they were just sort of like skirting around rebelliousness. But some kids he didn't know so well call him into the pool hall. And he figures, wow, these are the cool kids. Let me hang out with them. And he goes in. And one of them takes out some drugs. This kid had never done drugs before. And offers him some drugs. And he said normally he would have been very tempted to take it. He was always into looking for newer, bigger, and better thrills in life. But he said, as he reached for this drug, you know what flashed in his head? What flashed in his head was his father's face benching him the night before. And as his father's face flashed before him, Shays on the Musyukno Shalaviv, right? As that happened, he thought to himself, my father expects better of me. He expects better of me. He doesn't want me to do this. He knows I'm better than this. And almost viscerally, without even thinking, he takes the drug, throws it back in the face of the kid who gave it to him, and he runs outside and goes back home. And in his therapy session that morning, he almost took a shvuah. He said, I know I'm better than this, and I will never do it, because I know that's what my parents expect of me. So that's take-home message number one. Take-home message number one is cue in to the weakness, to the uniqueness of your child. It's not their weakness. Interesting, psychologists might interpret that. Tune into the uniqueness of your child, okay? And try to fan the flames, because that's where their greatness lies. That when you help them reach that, and you accept it, and you fan the flames, that's almost certainly where you're going to get to a place where your dreams for them will be realized. Because it has to be not your dreams for them. It has to be you're, again, giving them a bracha in a way that matches their unique capabilities. Part two, which is related to this, but since it's the title of the talk, I want to talk about it. Fascinating research. There's this guy, John Mordechai Gottman. John Mordechai Gottman has to be a Baal Tshuva. He goes around the world with a big yarmulke on his head. But that's not why I'm talking about him. He's considered the leading marital therapy researcher of our time. Certainly in this country, probably in the world. His stuff is published in the leading journals, and everybody respects his stuff. And he's gotten fighting among couples down to such a science that he has them come to his lab in Seattle. They'll have a couple fights. And after 7 minutes, he can tell with 94% accuracy if they'll be divorced in 5 years. Okay, not bad. And he has it. I could share with you if you want what the predictors are, but it'll depress you, so I'm not going to tell you. But maybe I will talk about it, because actually he doesn't then give you the card of a divorce lawyer. He then tries to fix it. He tries to fix it. So just think about it. And by the way, the research shows that what works in a marriage is what works in parenting also. And it's interesting. It's a side issue. Maybe we'll talk about it in discussion. The predictors about how to fight right in a marriage is very similar to the way to be a good parent. He says that an ominous sign is harsh startup. Harsh startup is where you start screaming and yelling at each other right away. So right away, when there's screaming and yelling and criticism, there's harsh startup. He says the problem with that is usually there's then harsh shutdown. And when there's harsh shutdown, you never cure anything. So people end up never solving anything in their disagreements. And then the other has to do with how much respect you have for each other. Is there contempt? Do you stop? Do you forget what you fell in love with in the first place? And then there are other ingredients like the ability to not be overly critical in the relationship, etc. Okay, common sense stuff, but he really has it down to a science. But there's something very interesting that I want to talk about, just because it's relevant to the concept of validation. And what it is about is the male-female differences in talking things out. How do mothers differ than fathers? And what he finds is the following thing. He says, usually, difficult discussions in a marriage are started by the woman, not by the man. And he, among other things, hooks people up to biofeedback equipment as he has them fight. And he measures their physiologic responsivity to stress as they fight. And he finds a very interesting set of gender differences. The more women talk about what's upsetting them by their husbands, the more their pulse rate goes down, the more their blood pressure goes down, the more they chill out. They just feel good. They love talking, okay? Men, on the other hand, 80% of men, not all, but most men, the more they talk, the more their blood pressure goes up, the more their pulse rate goes up. They actually feel physically ill on average for a couple of hours after talking for a little while about what's upsetting them. So the very thing that's a refuah for the woman is a machla for the man. This is important to understand. So what do you do with that? What do you do with that in terms of marriage and in terms of the theme of tonight and in terms of parenting, especially mothers parenting sons, fathers parenting daughters? So I'm going to answer that with the story. And then that'll be part two and recommendation number two. That's very tied to recommendation number one. Story goes like this. It was the first Chai Lifeline retreat, right? Chai Lifeline is an organization for families of kids with facing serious illness. And I was going to give the first mental health talk Friday night at the first Chai Lifeline retreat. This was 18 years ago. I have to find better ways of spending my Shabbosos, right? So, and my wife tells me that all the time. Okay, so I don't listen. I just, because she talks and I'm a man. Okay, no, I do listen. I do. It's wonderful. Anyway, we get up. I get up Friday night. You'll hear this story. It's a nice story. So I get up Friday night, and everybody's nervous. Is this going to work? It's a very interesting thing, Chai Lifeline Shabbaton. You have the whole gamut of the Jewish community. You have Samar Hasidim at one end, intermarried couples at the other end, all bound together by the common experience of having a child, chas v'shalom, with cancer or other kinds of chronic or serious illnesses. So before I open my mouth, a couple comes charging down the center aisle, and the husband starts screaming at me. I didn't even say a word. And I'm thinking, I could be home, benching my kids. I could be home. And here's what he says. He says, you know something? He said, you're going to have my body here all Shabbos, but my mind is going to be a million miles away. I'm not going to listen to one word you say all Shabbos. And he storms back to his seat. So, of course, I run after him. I say, what's the deal? And here's what he tells me. He says, he's a doctor. He's a physician. His son had been diagnosed a year earlier with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And he had spent the past year nonstop, every waking second, researching the best possible treatment protocols he could find for his son's illness. But he said, I hate this shrinky stuff. I hate this talking stuff. It's not me, he said. He said, I'm finally spending Shabbos in a nice, beautiful resort hotel in the mountains. And you know what my wife's making me do? Go listen to you, okay? And she's in the background, saying to me, make him stay, make him stay. So I tell him, please go back to your room, okay? And he doesn't wait. He doesn't wait for me to hesitate for a second. He runs back to his room. I don't see him the rest of Shabbos. I don't see him again for quite some time. All Shabbos, his wife sits in the last seat in the last row, shooting these murderous glances at me like she wants to kill me. Okay. So that's the end of the story until 6 years later. 6 years later, at the same Shabbaton where I learned that beautiful lesson on how to bench your kids and how to mind that uniqueness, I was getting up to speak also. You would ask me to speak as part of the Friday night program. Priority one Shabbaton. So this is 6 years later, and I'm behind the shtender getting up to speak. Same couple comes walking down the aisle, comes charging down the aisle, and he sees I have post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm like ducking behind the shtender. I'm nervous. So he says, don't worry. And here's the story he tells me, and this is take-home message number two. He says that Shabbos 6 years earlier was the turning point in his marriage. It's a turning point in his marriage. He started to realize that his wife really benefits by this talking stuff. She likes. It's good for her. It helped her. She was very helped by the Shabbaton. She was helped by the group. She was helped by the sessions. It was what made her tick. She realized that, you know what? She had to respect her husband's coping strategies, which were more cerebral and more about problem solving, like many men. Not all men, but like many men. And he said then a very interesting thing happened. As he accepted his wife's style of dealing with stress, and she accepted his style of dealing with stress, they met halfway. When she accepted him and he accepted her, she became a little more open to his style of dealing with things. And he became more accepting of listening and talking. And he said, you know something? I'm going to come to all the sessions this Shabbos. By the way, what had happened was his child with cancer, thank God, was doing fine. He said he's going to make it. He's cancer-free. But as sometimes happens in families with that kind of stress, the older daughter now had become an at-risk rebellious kid. She came to your Shabbaton. But he came to every single session. And he asked questions. He really changed. But how did he change? He changed through acceptance. What's the nimshal? The nimshal is very often when we go head on with our children, trying to make them into something that they're not, and not learning the lesson of Ish Asher Kvi Berchaso, not learning the lesson of, you knew I was going to say this because it was the title you picked, of Ashrei Yishur. I learned this from Rabbi Cohn. I forget in whose name it was. But the word Hebrew word Ashrei, if you look it up in the Hebrew English Dictionary, it means the highest level of happiness. If you look it up, it says bliss. Ashrei is up there, okay? Is tied to the Hebrew word Yishur, which means to validate. There is nothing quite as happy-making as validating your child and getting them. And then, when they feel accepted, that's when they embrace your values. What made that boy throw the drugs back into the hands of the kid in the pool hall, not far from here? What made that happen? You know what made it happen? It wasn't his father lecturing him. It wasn't his mother nagging him. It was the love. It was the meaning of a bracha where clearly love was reflected back in the eyes of his father and the expectations of the good in him. So take home message number two is, again, Ashrei Yishur. To be understood, first understand. Okay? That's real take-home message number two, okay? To be understood, first understand. You want your kids to accept what you dream for them. You want them to be makabel, your bracha, in a way that a bracha, who doesn't have incredible dreams for their children? That's wonderful. We should all have dreams for our children. And we should all have high expectations for our children. But again, the best way to convey it is through acceptance. And then, if the relationship is good, this is one of the things the psychologists always say, rules without relationships equal rebellion. When it's all rules, no relationship, it's not going to work. But if it's in the context of a relationship, Chazal said it beautifully, in raising children, we have to find the balance between smol dochev imimik harebes. We need love, we need limits. We need the left hand pushing away, interestingly the weaker hand, the right hand bringing closer, and Rav Simcha Wasserman, in a brilliant insight, as he always had into parenting, says, what happens if you go home tonight and you take your children and you simultaneously do what the Gemara says and you push them away with one hand while bringing them closer with another hand, what'll happen? He says, you turn them around. You turn them around. Think of that imagery. Such a beautiful visual metaphor, right? You want to turn your kids around? Do that left-right, kind of small doch of mimic karebis. They need both. By the way, if it's all love, no limits, your kids are going to be a problem, okay? Maybe we'll talk about the kind of limits that work next. I'll go into that in a little bit of detail, and then we'll really get into that in discussion. But the bottom line is, that the machla of this generation of parents, unfortunately, there's plenty of love to go around. It's very rare that I find families that don't have a lot of love. It happens. But there's often a lot of love, unless people are just so overwhelmed with financial distress or psychological issues. But usually there's enough love. The problem is saying no. The problem is the limits. There's a beautiful medrash I came across on a pasuk. In Mishlei. Pasuk of Mishlei says, Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva ve'el hamiso al titei nafshecha. Very interesting pasuk. It says, put limits on your kids, there's always hope, and don't pay attention to their screaming and yelling. So there's a medrash on this pasuk that is unbelievable to Western ears, to our ears. Here's what the medrash says, but it's so true psychologically. The medrash says, kol hamosif av Yisurim al bino, Mosif haben ahava al aviv. The more a parent The more a father puts limits on his son, the more that son will reflect back love to his father. And boy, is that true. If it's a flexible set of limits, and if it's limits put with love and put in the context of a connection and the context of that benching and holding their hand and appreciating their uniqueness, it's going to take hold. So what kind of limits work in terms of that small dochim im kareves? The limits that work are the limits that are, number one, unemotional. Not delivered with yelling and screaming, but limits that basically are just sort of logical, unemotional, delivered because it just flows from the misbehavior. We'll talk about the specifics during the discussion. Limits that are brief. You don't want to ground your child for the rest of his or her life. It doesn't tend to work, and it also doesn't work unless it makes sense. If the limits flow from the misbehavior, it's much more likely to work. Okay? So we could talk about this. I know a lot of this is going to sound very theoretical until we talk about it. I know people are going to ask me questions about a kid whining and a kid not listening and a kid being non-compliant. I've been doing this for enough time that there's a certain set of questions I get, certain sections of Brooklyn and elsewhere, having to do with the age of the parents, which is good because it means that we're all struggling with the same stuff. But in terms of the limits, that's the idea. The idea is you can't raise a child without limits. The beauty of Chazal's insight is unbelievable. It's exactly what psychological research is showing today. Showing that if you raise a kid all left, no right, all right, no left, there's all kinds of problems that come from either extreme. You raise them with what psychologists call authoritative parenting, which is the balance between the love and limits, which is exactly what was said thousands of years ago in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, and two other times in Shas, and a few, etc. Okay. A drop on the love, and then I'll end with the story, and we'll get some discussion going. A little bit on the love, even though I don't feel that... Look at this crowd. This is nice. This is a nice community, you know? Okay? Tissues for people, and I'm not even making people cry. Okay. So here's a little bit on the love. I think people, the love is there. The love is there. The problem is that time and this guy over here. No, oh, this isn't it. This is a, I think I just did something bad to this. Oh, no, it's okay. I was going to show my trio, okay? The BlackBerry, the trios, things like that, okay? My two-year-old grandson came in to visit from Eretz Yisrael summer before last. And he brought his mother and father with him, but the main thing was he came. I was all excited because I got to go to the park for the first time in a generation. It had been a generation since I had an excuse to go to the park. So I schlepped the poor kid to the park. I don't think he was that interested in going, but I wanted to go to the park. So I go to the park, and the first thing that hits me is a row of swings in the park near my house, and all fathers pushing their kids. I was very excited. Because I said to myself, wow, fathers are much more actively involved than they used to be. I go closer to the swings to put my grandson in one of the swings, and I see a Bluetooth in every ear, okay? So all the fathers, I'm telling you, every one of them was on the phone. So they were there, and they weren't there. They were there, and they weren't there. And believe me, you know, if the beautiful Kutzker is based on the pasuk of the end of Tillim, Chitzim B'Yagibar Kein B'nei Hanu'urim. He compares raising children, or Chinuch Habanim, to being an archer, and the Kutzker asks, why is it that the analogy of an archer is used about raising children? What does raising children have to do with being an archer? And he says that just like with an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes. So too with our children. The closer we hold them to our heart, with really being there for them, really spending time with them, not being distracted by a million emails and a million phone calls and all the other distractions of the day, to try to find time that we're really there for them. Because that, in the research, is a clear way that they will be much more likely to feel validated, to feel that we're really there. What do they see reflected in our eyes? The love of that boy on the Friday night before where he saw his father's loving expectations, or preoccupation with what's going on at work. My wife's a lawyer at a large firm in Midtown, okay? She still manages to find plenty of time for the kids, and Baruch Hashem has done an incredible job. But I was at her firm's retreat last year, and they said something that was unbelievable to me. Unbelievable. They announced at the retreat that the lawyers at this firm, or the firm as a whole, get 1 million pieces of email a week. 1 million pieces of email, because I didn't believe it. So I go to the head of the firm, who happens to be a firm guy. I say, you can't, that must have been a typo. You must mean 1,000 pieces, 1 million pieces? He said, no, 1 million pieces of email a week. My father said it beautifully recently. He said, it's an age of communication without connection, information without knowledge. Communication without connection, information without knowledge. Okay? And that's key. Because if we're there for our kids, that's when they internalize our values. That's when they internalize our values. We have to really be there. They have to know that we're there. It doesn't mean we have to shut the cell phones off all the time or trash the Blackberries or whatever it is. But it means that we have to steal some time with them where they know that there's no thing more important in our lives than our spending time with them. There's the research that shows that every night a week that a parent spends that dinner with their child, there's correspondingly lower risks for drug abuse. Okay, this is research done at Columbia. If you have dinner with your child one night a week, lower risk for drug abuse than zero nights a week, two nights a week, etc. But people are out going to parenting lectures. I don't know. Okay. That's my favorite. What's that?
After dinner.
It's after dinner, right. That's my favorite introduction of all time. Somebody was... wasn't so happy with there being a parenting talk. So he introduced me. He says, the number one risk factor to our children in America today is parents are never home because they're going to parenting lectures. And then that was my introduction. It's great, you know. Anyway, okay. So that's the time dimension. Let me end with a story, and then we'll go to questions. The story about validation, and it goes like this. There was a boy from a wonderful family, really wonderful family, but he was a little troubled. He was troubled partly because he had an attention deficit, maybe a little bit of a learning disability. He came from a family that really valued learning nonstop. It was a mirror or die family, okay? And he didn't make it. He just didn't make it. Very wealthy family, very successful, wonderful family, but he didn't make it. And sometimes these kids, they get marginalized and they find solace in ways they shouldn't. So, and he wasn't very smart when it came to not getting caught. He always managed to get caught. So he decides he's going to experiment with some marijuana. So as soon as Shabbos is over, he goes to the stairwell of a neighborhood in the New York metropolitan area and decides to light up, he tells me, for the first time ever. And who goes walking by on his way back because he keeps 72 minutes from shul? His Rosh Yeshiva. Okay, not such great judgment. And he immediately kicks him out of the yeshiva, calls the parents, and they call me in a panic. And I immediately call him. I say, does anybody know about this? He says, no, nobody knows. Don't worry. No, I'm going to protect his reputation, but there's no room in my yeshiva for a kid who smokes marijuana. How he knew it was marijuana is an interesting question. That's another, okay. I'll cut you a deal. I said, I'm gonna fax you, I got his home fax, a report on a drug report once a month. Because marijuana stays in your system for about a month, that he's clean every month. I'm going to give you a weekly phone call with a psychotherapy summary on how he's doing. And if I miss any one of those things, then you could kick him out, no problem. But give him a chance. Nobody knows. Your yeshiva's reputation is not in play now. It's totally anonymous now. It won't cost you a dime to do it. So he says, okay. But he says, I'm telling you, you miss one fax of one drug report, or you miss one phone call to me a week, he's out. I said, fine. And I start to see the kid, a wonderful kid. And he was a kid who was in a lot of pain. He was self-medicating a depression with the marijuana. He was feeling terrible. You know, kids do drugs either to feel good or to feel better. He was doing it to feel better. He was depressed. He was feeling horrible about himself. And it was because he had all these older siblings. They were all superstars, each one a bigger Talmud Chacham than the next. They were all, And he was feeling like all his parents really cared about was that. And here he is. He was street smart, but he certainly had no school smarts whatsoever. And I'm seeing him for a couple of months. And I finally realized I'm not getting very far with him. I mean, he'd stopped smoking and he was staying in the yeshiva, but he was still miserably unhappy. So I said, who gets you? And we talk about validation. Who validates you? Where do you get your ashrei yishur? Who understands you? He said, well, the only person who really understands me is my grandfather, my father's father. That's the patriarch of the business that's supporting the family. So I said, well, I have permission to invite your grandfather to a session with your parents, because maybe he'll shed some light on this and help everybody get you better. So grandfather didn't know anything about what had happened to his grandson, but I had permission to share it with him. So I get him into my office with the parents and with the kid, and I tell him what happened. And immediately, you talk about harsh startup, he goes into a harsh startup. He looks at his son, and he starts to scream big time. And he says, don't you know why this family exists? He says, don't you know? Didn't you ever tell him why we're alive today? And he turns to his grandson. He says, you're 15, right? He said, when I was 15, we were living in Europe. And all my older siblings were big-time Talmidei Chachamim. And they were all learning nonstop. And I kept begging my parents. I kept saying, Hitler's going to kill us all. He's going to kill every one of us. We have to get out of here. He's going to kill us. And they all looked at me. And then he turns to me and he says, and you know, if they believed in shrinks back then, they would have sent me to somebody like him, you know. So he goes on to say, he said, look, he said, I saw what was happening. I couldn't stand it anymore. I ran away from home. I get on a boat, and I manage to find myself to America, and I start the business. It's supporting everybody. And it was supporting everybody, including a number of big yeshivas as well. And he said, why? He says, it's because of the street smarts that this kid is showing. And he looks at his son and looks at his daughter-in-law, and he says, if you can't make room in your hearts for this neshama, I don't want to have anything to do with you. He goes on to say, turns to his grandson, he says, you know what happened to all of them? My father killed. My mother killed. My brothers, my sisters, my nephews, my nieces. I'm the only one alive. This is all that's left. And he says, make room. Make room. And he gets up, and he slams the door of my office, drives away. I never see him again. And there was this stunned silence in the room. Stunned silence. And they're all crying. They're all crying. This week's parsha has tears in it. The tears of confusion, but ultimately the tears of insight and the tears of getting something. And they expanded their bumper sticker. They really did. They made room for him. They understood him. And now they saw him as having the spark in his neshama. That's the reason why the family existed. They made him into a hero in the family because they really got it. Today, and this is a true end of the story. This is many, many years ago. Today, he's running the business, and his brothers all work for him. Okay? True story. True story. So, with that happy note, let's end with this. Let me summarize what I've said until now. So, what I've said until now is basically about the lesson of the parsha. The lesson of the parsha is the biggest bracha that we could give our children is validating them, is getting them. It's recognizing their uniqueness. It's capturing that and fanning the flames, even if it means that we have to modify a little bit what our dreams are. The Kutzker said, there is nothing as unequal as the equal treatment of the unequal. Think about that, okay? Only the Kutzker could say it that way. The most unequal thing is the equal treatment of the unequal. Think about it. That's the bottom line take-home message of tonight. It's the bottom line take-home message of this week's Parsha. And may we all be zocha to find the unique spark in all of our children so that they realize their dreams, and through that they all grow up to live lives of happiness and fulfillment. First question, go ahead.
Well,
You're out, yeah. It's right, right. So the question is, just to repeat, it's a very important point, which actually Rabbi Cohn is the true expert on. And the point is, the point is that, you know, even if you listen to every word I said tonight, how powerful is that going to be if your kids go tomorrow morning to yeshiva, where there's a very different kind of expectations, and where you, by just thinking a little bit out of the box, you could get kicked ass. Let me just say two things. One is that I wish there was a way to make it a much more serious process go on before you ask a kid to leave a yeshiva. It has such an incredible impact on their lives that it's literally could be seen in some cases as dine nefashos. And I'll tell you a story which shows, if we have to ask a kid to leave, how far you have to go in terms of being careful about it. I have many stories like this. This is my favorite one. There was a principal of a mesifta in Eretz Yisrael a number of years ago. And there was a kid who he felt was a rodef. It was a kid who had a very bad influence on a bunch of other kids in the yeshiva. And he went to Rav Shach at the time to ask him for psak on whether or not he had a right to kick this kid out. It really is a shiloh, because it's really an incredibly complex set of competing needs of the individual versus the rabbin, what makes the person a rodef. And Rav Shach reluctantly answered, yeah, he's a rodef, if you could ask him to leave. About 6 months later, the same principal had to go to Panovich again to ask Rav Shach another shiloh. And he's kept waiting outside for an inordinate amount of time. And he waits and waits and waits. Over an hour later, the office of Rav Shach opens, and Rav Shach comes out of his office with the Gemara in one hand and his arm around the boy who had been kicked out 6 months earlier. And the principal says, what is this? What's this about? And Rav Shach looks at him and says, well, somebody has to learn with them. So Rav Shach was unwilling to make that psak without taking a personal responsibility. A man as busy as Rav Shach, who was carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders, and even then I think he was quite elderly, okay? He was not willing to do it unless he figured out what's going to be with this boy. And I think that's the attitude we have to have. You know, the attitude we have to have is one that you have to be very, very careful. And there are all kinds of alternatives without ruining the reputation of a school. I think people sometimes are way too fast. Everything I said today about validating and about the uniqueness of a child, I think goes just as strongly for yeshiva. And we have to be careful about that, because sometimes we try to get our kids into a cookie-cutter place. Yeah. One of you was raising your hand before. And then I'll go back and forth, yeah. Yes, the question is how do you know how do you know what your kid's real potential is unless you push them up against it? The research shows, this is just psychology research, that the ideal balance you want to get with kids is to set expectations for them a little bit beyond the ceiling for them. So we should always have them raise those expectations for them, just so that they always have to push themselves at least a little bit. The research shows if you set the expectations too high, they're going to give up, like that boy did. If you set them too low, that's just as dangerous. The art of doing that is something that all you could do is just see what happens in the best of possible worlds, where you give him or her the ultimate support, and you know, the Gemara tells us we have to find the balance between having a child learn Masha Libo Chafetz and Misha Libo Chafetz. Right? There's a lot of tremendous insight. That's a talk in itself on motivation, but I'll just tell you one thing. And that's that one of the best ways to know is to really know your child well and to really communicate with them. Hear them. Look, do they really try? Do they really push themselves? And then you just said, but if you said it in a collaborative way, not in a judgmental way, so that it's a challenge and not a threat, that's when they're going to reach their highest potential. If it's filled with tension, okay, that's not conducive to learning. It has to be filled with your love for learning being communicated to them. And that's when you know they're going to hit the ceiling. Okay, so that's basically it. Yes? Yeah. So the question is, how do you? You're talking about a community or the school or both? You're talking about both. I think the most important. I don't have any easy answers because you're right. It's a societal kind of issue. I think that what's important though is that at least in the four walls of your house, the Dalai Lamas of your own inner world with your kid. You have to make them feel special and unique and loved for who they are. So that even if they're up against, look, everybody goes up against certain kinds of people or situations where people aren't going to appreciate their uniqueness. It happens at work. It happens in the marketplace. It happens everywhere. To me, the key is that if you raise them, creating a protective shield for them where they really know that you believe in them, and you really help them in any way you can to reach their potential, that's the best inoculation against a more hostile environment. Look, you have to go to bat for them if something really egregious is happening in the school but or in the community. But the reality is that you could only have control over what you have control over. Maybe you could become an activist in changing community expectations. I've known individuals who have changed expectations of schools, and I know individuals who have started new schools in response to what they felt was an overly cookie-cutter approach. And I know individuals who have gone on crusades in communities to get real change going. You know, so to a certain extent, you can affect community change. But the most important thing is to focus on what you have control over and then go from there. I wish I had an easier answer. But I think but you're right. I can't talk about this in isolation from what's out there, and what's out there definitely, you know, feeds our anxieties as well. But it makes it all the more important for us to create that sphere of love for the kids where their spark is kept ignited and where you have them believe in themselves in spite of whatever failures they meet out there. Okay? I mean, I don't know what else we could do. You have any other ideas? I mean, I wish I knew. Huh?
In my house, I talk about that there's a poor people look at me like someone on the world. But I say this is what I have to do.
Right. Okay. Okay. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so I'll give a very concrete answer, although it's a very complex question also. The question was she's a preschool teacher, and she's already seeing a number of kids. You could look at a kid now and pretty much predict that this is the next generation of at-risk kids. And what do you do about that? And who's tracking them? And how do you handle that? The reality is that the research shows the earlier you identify and the earlier you intervene, the better is the chance that you'll be able to do something. The kind of behaviors that are persistent markers for a preschooler is if a kid is unusually aggressive, unusually oppositional, unusually defiant, unusually hyperactive. There's some mixed data on that, but basically, if they're at the extreme end of that, especially aggression, and especially social problems relative to peers, those kids there really should be aggressive follow-up of. Now, I understand, what's the address? The address should be, we've been, a number of people in the field of working with at-risk kids or NEFESH, an organization for mental health professionals, have been pushing very strong to have early identification at the level that you're teaching at, because that's when you could get them. And if you could get them the right kind of help, you may be able to really save them from having a lifelong kind of bad outcome. So it depends where you are. Some schools have gotten better at early intervention, and other schools and communities have to learn how to do that. But ultimately, it's where the least amount of effort will yield the most result. So, yeah. Yeah, I hear. And there, by the way, there are a percentage of kids who do grow out of it. And Masavos is similar to Lebanon for a lot of people, so it's complicated. Look, if it's a school that's attached to an elementary school, that's where you really need, hopefully access to good, solid mental health support consultation services, because there's a list of behaviors that are predictive of later problems and others that are not. So, for example, certain behaviors that come to a teacher's attention in preschool, 9 out of 10 chance that it's going to be gone 2 years down the road. Other behaviors are much more persistent. But your kids deserve that kind of expert consultation. And we need to throw some resources into that. I agree completely. I wish I had the power and the resources to do it. But you're right. In the back, and then I'll come here. Yeah. I mean, where they're always getting in trouble in school, or Right, and that's so. The question is, it's the theme of the night in terms of questions, right? It's a variation on the theme of what we've been discussing. Is so, if you have an ADHD child and you really believe in their uniqueness, but you know they're going to go back and spend 90% of their day in an environment that doesn't appreciate that uniqueness, what do you do? Look, what's in your control to do? Don't sell it short. I've seen many ADHD adults who had a mother or father really believe in them when they were younger, and that's what kept them going. So you don't belittle the importance of a mother's love and a father's love and a mother's belief in her child. That goes a long, long way. It really goes a long way. in terms of, and then to be an advocate for them in a realistic way in school really goes a long way also. You know, ultimately, kids are resilient, and a lot of the character, you know, there was just a fascinating set of articles in the press quoting a new article in one of the psychology journals showing that most dyslexics, or an inordinately high percentage of kids with dyslexia, with a reading disorder, end up being very successful entrepreneurs as adults beyond what you would expect in the general population. I used to always wonder, why is it that Hashem made every kind of temperament? There's so many different temperaments. So I wondered, why was the really difficult temperament created? Then I came across a study that showed that during a famine in Ethiopia, the kids who survived, were most likely to survive, were the kids who cried in the most obnoxious manner known to man and who were negatively persistent that way. They're the ones who made it. So there's something protective about everything, including certainly attention deficit. You know, my experience giving talks to Hatzolah members, okay, is you can't talk to a group, at least Hatzolah people I've spoken to, most wonderful organization around, right? And I have to throw things at them, dance around them. I can't give a normal talk to them because they're otherwise they just put off their beepers and run off to an emergency call before I could get one sentence out. They all seem to have attention deficit. Thank God. We need people like that. You know, there's a very, very successful yeshiva, huge yeshiva, an incredibly successful yeshiva. I won't name it because I don't know that I have permission. But every time the Rosh Yeshiva sees me, who started this yeshiva from nothing and now it's this huge campus and is incredibly successful. He calls me up. He says, Pelkovitz, come here. He says, if you put me on Ritalin when I was 7 years old, you see all this? It would be marshland, okay? And he's right. He's right. So the uniqueness of an attention deficit person, we need it. We have to have it. And we just have to convey that belief to them so that eventually, I think about some of the kids I knew growing up who were the most out-of-control conduct problems. And looking back on it, they probably all had attention deficit. And today, one is, you know, the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. The other started a whole city in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, just like unbelievable things came from them. And the other has the valedictorian of the class working in his shipping department. You know, it's that kind of thing, and it's true. It's true. Yes. See, only a father would ask that question. That's a good father. It's a good question. It's a good father. His question is could only have come from this side of the room. It's very valid. It really is a valid question. Could it be too much? Do we have to toughen our kids up to let them know, hey, listen, you know, you gotta, you know, sometimes life isn't always so great, and you're not gonna always have people at your side backing you. And is there such a thing as having our children drown in our chicken soup? That's the question. I think the answer is this. Look, the answer is you can't love a kid too much. You can, though, mess things up. You can mess things up by saving them from facing the consequences of their own mistake. And let me go on this. It's a very important point because the falsely elevated self-concept is as dangerous as a falsely based negative self-concept. They did a fascinating study, a sociologist at University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He wanted to look at the top 1% of neurosurgeons and compare them to the worst neurosurgeons. So who are the neurosurgeons? You know, to become a neurosurgeon, you're not even finished till you're well into your 30s, okay? You know, all those years of college, medical school, 5 years of general surgery, and then you just keep specializing and subspecializing, and you're finally at, you have to be brilliant to be a neurosurgeon. You're literally a brain surgeon. So he looked at what differentiates the neurosurgeons who have the lowest death rates and the most success from the ones who end up getting fired. And it turned out it wasn't intelligence. It wasn't manual dexterity. You know what it was? It was how they handled their mistakes. The top 1% of neurosurgeons, if they, God forbid, lost a patient on the table, they would be energized in a way that they would not go home till they figured out what went wrong. They'd go to the library. They'd read every article they could find on it. They'd call the other experts in the field. They'd go to the animal lab and do the surgery over and over and over again on those poor animals. And they would literally not rest until they understood what they did wrong. The bottom 1% is a scary thing to read, that section of the study. They'd say things, those OR nurses, they are so incompetent. And the lighting of the OR room is terrible, and the equipment is old, never even for a second looking at their own part in it. So one of the gifts we give to our children is the gift of looking at what you do wrong and acknowledging it in a healthy way. Last week's Parsha, when the brothers admit to having made a mistake, that's when Yosef cries and good things start coming their way. Earlier, when they don't admit to their mistakes, they get themselves in trouble. So that's very, very much what you're saying is very, very important. So we have to not always save our children from the impact of their errors. We have to push them, and very often the fathers are the specialists in holding them accountable. The fathers are the small docha specialists, the mother are the Amim HaKareva specialists. That's the way it's been for all time. And that's good. We need both. We need both. And you just have to do it with love. You know, you have to do it with love. Okay, thank you everybody.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.